Welcome to the New World. Episode 15, Four Parts Together. Last episode, we got a brief history of the Mayan civilization, from their origins in the Yucatan thousands of years ago, to their apocalyptic collapse around the turn of the second millennium. Then, we talked about the arrival of Francisco Montejo, his plans to turn the Yucatan into a giant plantation, and his ultimate failure to do so. One of the reasons for this failure was that Montejo had a short supply of conquistadors, who were choosing instead to go to Peru with Francisco Pizarro. Today, I wanted to talk about the empire they sought to plunder, the greatest empire in the history of South America, Tahuantinsuyo, the land of the Incas. Let's do what we did with the Aztecs, and give an entire episode to the history of the Incas just before Pizarro lands in the 1530s. Because as it turns out, the Incas were right in the middle of a dramatic power struggle, and the Spanish arrived at the perfect time and place. Before I begin, let me just give a disclaimer that there is an entire podcast dedicated to the history of the Incas. It just so happens to be called The History of the Incas, and if you can believe it, you can probably find it just about anywhere you're listening to this podcast. Anyway, let's get to it. Peru is one of the oldest places in the world inhabited by human civilization. The Nordachico River Valley was the host of cities by the year 3500 BC, around the same time the Egyptians were beginning to construct pyramids. Peru made an extraordinary home for these people. The coastline, an area you might think to be hospitable, is in fact a thin strip of arid desert that gets extremely little rainfall. As you continue eastward, the foothills of the Andes Mountains spring forth from the ground suddenly. There is little farmland here, but people make do by farming on terraces carved out of the steep river valleys, up to 4,000 feet above sea level. They also fished out of the many rivers, streams, and lakes flowing down from the peaks. Above this point, the mountains flatten out somewhat into grasslands where llamas and alpacas graze. These creatures would prove to be valuable animals for the region, as they can be used for wool, meat, and also the carrying of goods from place to place. One can find an abundance of biodiversity in this region, not just in animals, but also plants. The Incas would come to domesticate over 1,000 variants of potatoes alone, sometimes growing many kinds on one plot of land. Moving eastward past the peaks, the Andes descend down into the Amazon rainforest, where tropical birds and jaguars can be found lurking in the tree-covered hills. The lack of large amounts of fertile farmland kept these communities fairly small. But before the Incas came along, there were plenty of nations. There were the Chavín and the Huari on the north coast, the Nazca on the south coast, and the Tiwanku from the shores of Lake Titicaca to the southeast. By the 1100s, all of these empires had come and gone, and Peru was split between many smaller nations for the next several centuries. The origins of the people that would become the Inca have mythological versions, as it tends to be with great empires. Legend has it that in the 1200s, four brothers and four sisters, created by the sun god Inti, emerged from a cave near Lake Titicaca and left to find a new home. Others, created by the gods, also followed. The eldest brother, Ayar Manco, had a staff of gold given to him by Inti, and declared that wherever he set it down was where his people would now live. On the journey, Ayar Manco's brothers met with unfortunate accidents, or perhaps he got rid of them to ensure that he would be the sole leader. When they found the spot, he sank his staff into the earth, and thus the city of Cuzco was founded, with the newly named Manco Capoc as its first ruler. He became the Sapa Inca, meaning the only Inca. Of course, this story is just a myth. The reality is more simple, that a nomadic group from the lake moved to Cuzco with Manco as its leader. But tales like these are much more interesting and always worth talking about. From here, the kingdom of Cuzco, under Manco's descendants, faced several foes who proved to be an existential threat. Little by little, they fought and expanded and survived, and seven generations of rulers carried on after Manco Capac. In 1438, the eighth Sapa Inca, Viracocha Inca, who had ruled for the last 18 years, went to war with the kingdom of Chanca. When the Chanca army attacked the gates of Cuzco, the warrior king Viracocha led a heroic defense, and by that I mean he fled the city, along with his son and crown prince Urco Inca. The man left in charge of the city's defenses was another of Viracocha's sons, Inca Yupanqui. With the odds against him, Yupanqui managed to pull off a startlingly successful victory, not only defeating the enemy, but also capturing several of the Chanca leadership in the process. Apparently, the gods themselves turned stones of the battlefield against Yupanqui's enemies. When Viracocha and Urco sheepishly returned, they realized that Yupanqui the Earthshaker, as he was now known, was extremely popular among the army that they had abandoned. Naturally, Viracocha saw Yupanqui as his rival and planned to have him killed, but the plot was exposed and he was exiled. The crown prince Urco Inca was killed. Yupanqui now went by the title of the Earthshaker, or Pachacuti, and was crowned the new Sapa Inca. Just as Itzcoatl was the Tlatoani that propelled the Aztecs to become regional hegemons, so too would Pachacuti become the Sapa Inca to lead his people to greatness as well. He began with his neighbors. Many of Cuzco's supposed allies didn't support them when the Chanca arrived, so they were crushed under the Inca boot. Then, Pachacuti's armies were unleashed on the whole of the central Andes, and province after province became subjugated. Aymaraes, Omaysayos, Cotapampas, Chilques, Angara, Huanca, Tarma, all fell before him. Rebellious subjects and rival generals were disciplined with lethal harshness. For 25 years, the Earthshaker proved his excellent generalship. When his son Topa came of age in 1463, he continued in his father's stead, while the aging Sapa Inca attended to domestic matters. Pachacuti did more than just expand the Inca domain. In many ways, he redefined what it meant to be Inca. Firstly, he rebuilt his imperial capital of Cuzco. The Inca capital wasn't just a city in the same way that Tenochtitlan was. Commoners were forbidden in the city walls at night, and only nobility could live there. If the Incas were going to be ruling the Andes, they needed a capital worthy of their ambitions. The city's residents were forced to leave their homes, and the whole place was razed to the ground. Inca builders then worked to recreate the city, based on a clay model of Pachacuti's personal design. The emperor had Cuzco rebuilt in the shape of a puma. The residences formed the body, and the confluence of two rivers was its tail. Between the legs were plazas where highways converged, and at the head was the temple complex known as Sacsayhuaman, which my source calls the largest megalithic structure in the Western Hemisphere, with blocks on its walls weighing over 100 tons. Pachacuti was apparently so meticulous in his planning that he personally assigned each resident of the city to their new house and staked out property lines with his own hands. Does that sound a little bit unreasonable to you? Well, perhaps that's because many accuse Pachacuti of literally rewriting history to suit his own ends. That's not uncommon, of course. Many of our sources for emperors of the past, like Alexander or Augustus, were histories written at their behest, and are naturally very biased in their favor. Pachacuti may have rewritten not only his own history, but that of the previous Sapa Inca as well. This is why Manco Capac's killing of his own brothers might sound so similar to Pachacuti killing his brother Urco and exiling his father Viracocha. Next were Pachacuti's extensive public works programs. The empire reached far and wide now, so it needed to be connected and restructured, literally. new terrace farms, new storehouses for food and warehouses for goods, aqueducts for cities, and an amazing series of roads to link it all together. With this system of infrastructure, messengers, trade, and most importantly, armies, could move through the mountains with lightning speed. He built estates for himself and the other nobility as well. You may recognize one of them, the Citadel of Machu Picchu, one of the most famous tourist attractions in all of South America. The people of the Andes had been entirely remade. No longer was there the Kingdom of Cuzco. Now it was Tahuantinsuyu, or four parts put together in the Inca language. These four parts were four administrative districts, in the northeast, southwest, southeast, and southwest, with Cuzco at their center. It was a true empire. The Earthshaker also reorganized the Inca religion. The people of the Andes practiced ancestor worship and mummified their dead. These mummies weren't just sealed away in tombs like Egypt, though. The Inca dead were supposed to continue to be a part of society even after their demise. Being kept between this world and the next meant that mummies had some supernatural powers. In return for being kept in a cave or a house and being guarded, clothed, and sometimes even fed, a mummy was seen as being able to maintain the flow of food and water to their living descendants. Not everyone was mummified, though. Only the more noble of Inca society were mummified, and dead emperors were, of course, treated the best. A dead emperor would retain his lands and titles, be provided with food and drink, and would even be brought out for entertainment. If a mummy was lost, real-world chaos could ensue. The destruction of your ancestral mummy could mean losing your land, your rights to the local water supply. If your ancestors can't protect your resources, why should you have them? Keeping land, water, and titles in a dead body meant that the living were forced to go out and find more, which is part of the reason why the Inca war machine would spring up so suddenly. The Inca also worshipped gods, of course, including the creator god Viracocha, the sun god Inti, and, thanks to Pachacuti, the Sapa Inca. The emperor made himself a god, claiming that he could speak with the pantheon and directly petition them for aid. This, of course, extended to ancestral mummies as well, meaning that emperors living or dead were now considered divine. They worshipped these gods, both new and old, by several means. There were prayers, rites such as fasting or abstinence, and even a hand gesture made when addressing the gods, similar to how the Christians make the sign of the cross. The Incas also practiced sacrifice. Usually it was by burning food or killing animals like llamas or guinea pigs, but in extremely dire cases, the Incas sacrificed children. These children were under the age of 16 and were always volunteered by their families. They were given food and drink, and then they were killed, either by strangulation or by the cutting of the throat. The Incas saw this as a solemn and serious affair, not something to be done often, like with the Aztecs. It only happened when it was deemed absolutely necessary. Still, it does not spare them from the judgment of others, like the Spanish. In 1471, Pachacuti the Earthshaker finally died after 33 very successful years of rule. His son, Topa Inca, would carry the empire on to even greater heights. While his father was still alive, he had conquered lands of the old Chimú Empire in the north and the Nazca in the south, and had even perhaps taken an army out to the Galapagos Islands in the Pacific Ocean. During his 22 years as sole ruler, he defeated revolts and expanded the empire far, far to the south. Inca banners waved in what is today central Chile, northwest Argentina, Bolivia, Peru, and Ecuador. It was quickly becoming one of the largest empires in the world at the time, bigger in terms of landmass than Spain. Topa Inca died in 1493, the same year Columbus was sailing around the Caribbean for the first time. His successor was perhaps the most powerful of all Inca emperors, past or future, his son, Huayna Capac. In terms of military conquests, his were minimal compared to his father and grandfather. He set the empire's northern boundary at the Ancasmayo River in southern Colombia and subdued many tribes in Ecuador, apparently at great cost in time and lives. He spent much of his time on the throne consolidating and building palaces in the northern parts of the country. Now that a little less is happening, let's discuss more about the Incas at their height. I've already discussed some of the Inca farming and the interesting challenges that came with living in the mountains. There wasn't much land, so every available outcropping had to be specialized. What's interesting about the Incas is that they spread out their agriculture vertically. If you were living at one altitude, you produced a different crop or animal than your family at a different one. Colonists settled areas, produced goods, shipped them back home, and received the goods produced in other cities as return. Let me just quote Charles Mann to show you what I mean. Quote, Andean communities sent out representatives and colonies to live up or down slope in places with resources unavailable at home, fish or shellfish from the ocean, beans, squash, and cotton from the coastal river valleys, maize, potatoes, and the Andean grain quinoa from the foothills, llamas and alpacas for wool and meat in the heights. Each area had something to contribute. Villagers in the satellite settlements exchanged products with the center, sending beans uphill and obtaining llama jerky in return, all while retaining their citizenship in a homeland they rarely saw. Combining the fruits of many ecosystems, Andean cultures enjoyed a better life than they could have wrested from a single place and spread out the risk from the area's frequent natural catastrophes. End quote. This is how communities in the Andes functioned naturally. When the Incas moved in, they would split the useful land into thirds. One went to the state clergy, one went to the emperor, and one was left over for the subsistence of the local villages. If this meant that the villagers wouldn't get enough to feed themselves, state authorities would initiate construction projects to simply build more land on terraces, or, if needed, give them a bigger share of what remained. Herds of alpacas and llamas could also be split up if no crops could be grown. Speaking of which, the cloth that these animals produced was valuable. So valuable, in fact, that the empire had a textile tax. Not only could alpaca wool clothe someone in the cool mountain air, it could also make bags that stuff could be carried in, and was even a part of religious ceremonies. A constant flow of cloth was necessary to keep the empire's economy functioning. Also necessary was labor, which was hard to come by with the sheer number of public work projects going on. A simple labor tax called the mita was introduced. Imagine being conscripted in the army, but instead of fighting, you pave a road or work in a mine for a year or so. The state would provide your food, your tools, and other equipment. Gordon McEwen theorizes that not only did this help to build the empire very quickly, but it also kept the many idle hands in the empire away from their potentially rebellious territories, while rewarding them for their labor at the same time. Charles Mann quotes a Spaniard who would later claim that the Inca took this to the extreme, moving people around on a redundant and pointless construction project for no real purpose other than to keep them busy. Food and wool weren't the only things that Huayna Capac's people produced. There were a great many kinds of pottery for many different uses. There were stone statues and figurines. Government officials provided templates so that artisans could produce their work in a standardized manner. And though they did not develop iron and steel, they were excellent metallurgists who made objects from gold, copper, silver, mercury, lead, and platinum. Alloys like bronze made tools, but shinier metals made religious imagery. McEwen says that the Spanish would report flowers and corn made of gold planted in the gardens of Inca temples. While the laborers made their goods in the countryside, the more intellectual types in the cities made their own advancements. The Andes, even today, are known as some of the best places in the world for stargazing, and so the Incas had an excellent point from which to view the Milky Way and all the planets. They conducted accurate population censuses, crafted pottery, and had an advanced enough system of mathematics to build the excellent system of civil engineering that we saw earlier. The downside to all this? Well, the method the Incas used to record their information was in quipu. Quipu isn't an alphabet or a system of pictographs. It's a system of knots. The Spanish never learned to read them, and the Inca would later switch to the Latin alphabet, so the knowledge of how to read quipu has unfortunately vanished. Though linguists and historians continue to try and decode them, many of the knots have degraded over time, and with them has gone much of the recorded knowledge of the Incas in their own words. The land of four quarters that Huayna Capac presided over was linked by perhaps the greatest and most enduring achievement of the Incas, their highways. 40,000 kilometers of stone-paved roads and dirt tracks connected all parts of the empire to its beating heart in Cuzco. Two main roads went from north to south, with plenty of branching off points along the way. What might come as a surprise is that commoners weren't allowed to travel on them without special permission. They were exclusively for state use. Armies needed to travel swiftly to go on campaign, or to suppress growing rebellions. Messengers also needed to get word from one place to another at top speed. Since the roads could only be a meter wide in some places, the last thing an army needed was to encounter a road choked by some peasant moving his llama herd down a mountainside. Though roads could be small, these weren't just some simple rocky paths we're talking about. Tunnels, bridges, retaining walls, and even zip lines made sure that agents of the emperor could get from one place to another as quickly as humanly possible, in any season and under any weather condition. The people of the Andes had no horses or camels to ride on, nor wheels with which to pull carts. All the same, an imperial message encoded in quipu could travel 240 kilometers, that's 149 miles, in a single day through a system of relay runners. The emperor could sit in Cuzco and eat fish delivered to him straight from the Pacific Ocean in less than 2 days. Way stations were built every 20 kilometers to house and feed people walking on their own, and well-stocked warehouses were also regularly constructed to make sure armies were just as well taken care of. This was the state of Tehuantinsuyu at the start of Huayna Capac's reign. Now that we know what it was, we can begin to talk about how it was changed. In the year 1527, two things arrived in the empire for the first time. One of them was the Europeans. If you listened to episode 13, then you know that Francisco Pizarro reached Tumbes in that year, and was well received by the people there. So well received, in fact, that he left fully intending to come back as soon as he could. Pizarro's arrival was duly reported to the emperor, but there was little else he could do. The other thing that arrived in Peru that year was smallpox. As we know, diseases do best in urbanized, well-connected, populated areas, and there was perhaps nothing that fit such a description better in the entire Western Hemisphere than in Tehuantinsuyu. The highways carried the disease just as well as anything, and it took its toll. We have no way of knowing how many died, but there's no doubt that if the Incas suffered as badly as the Triple Alliance did, then they died in the millions. I feel the need to stress this point, because it's easy to breeze by such a fact. Years before Pizarro came back to the Andes with a strong military force, the entire country had been totally crippled. Perhaps a third of its people were dead. Armies, farmers, civil servants, intellectuals, nobility. Such a military advantage comes rarely in the history of warfare. Among the casualties was none other than the Sapa Inca, Huayna Capac, and his heir. This was a disaster, of a kind the people of the Andes had not seen before. They had been united as one people, under one government, one emperor with absolute power. That emperor needed to be active and in control, and made his appearance be felt in every corner of the empire. Otherwise, it wasn't effective or efficient. That's why he needed armies to deter rebellion, and roads to move those armies quickly. Huaynacapoc had already been away from the capital for a long time before his death, and now that both he and his chosen heir were gone, where was absolute imperial authority supposed to come from? Well, the answer is Huascar. Who is Huascar? Why, the emperor, of course. Well, sort of. He was appointed co-ruler by his father, Huaynacapoc, to oversee the capital while he was away. The expectation was that he would take over when his father died, but unfortunately, Huaynacapoc decided he liked a different son even better, and appointed him heir instead while he was out on military campaign. This left Huascar in a bit of an awkward position when his father and brother died. It was clear that Huaynacapoc didn't mean for him to be his successor, but he hadn't been removed from authority by the time of his father's untimely demise. And obviously, he would now have to defend his title to the death if anyone challenged him. And wouldn't you know it, someone did. That someone was his own brother, the somewhat undistinguished Atahualpa, who had been up in Ecuador with his father and brother. They were dead now, of course, but their army was not. They'd served with Atahualpa, and they knew him, or at least they knew him better than Huascar. Out of a genuine love for him, or out of pure self-interest, they backed his claim. The sources for this civil war were Atahualpa's supporters, so naturally, Huascar is portrayed as a drunken fool who only held on to power because he effectively held the mummies of previous emperors as hostages. Remember, mummies have as much power in death as they did in life. Regardless of how Huascar really acted, he had many supporters, willing or otherwise. Enough, anyway, that he could fight the usurper Atahualpa and his men in a bloody civil war for 5 long years. After countless precious Inca lives were lost, Cuzco finally fell to Atahualpa in 1532, and Huascar was imprisoned. The defeated emperor's family was executed right in front of him. By all rights, the end of the civil war seemed to be a turning point back in the empire's favor. With no other rivals and the backing of the remaining nobility, Atahualpa held supreme power. With a long reign, he could bring stability back to Tehuantinsuyu. The smallpox plague was a disaster, of course, but they could recover. Oh yes, everything was going his way. Or so he thought. In October of 1532, the victorious Atahualpa was actually on his way to Cuzco to inaugurate his victory. In the small port of Cajamarca, he heard the news. Though he didn't quite know it yet, the new Earthshaker had returned. His name was Francisco Pizarro, and he would bring the whole of Tehuantinsuyu to its knees.